As a professional athlete, are you truly happy? It's an interesting question. For most of us, we probably think, oh, these guys are living the life. Is that true? Are you happy, contented, or is your whole life and your life's contentment revolving around results? Well, this is what this podcast is all about. In fact, this week's guest will give you some great tips on how to, well, manage that. This is the Thrive Podcast, the podcast which gives you the opportunity to, well, thrive. So welcome to another edition of the Thrive Podcast. I have to say that this week we have got an unbelievable guest. Best-selling author, positive psychology expert, former squash player, I believe. And, of course, he's a fantastic guest. I understand that he created the biggest ever attended course at Harvard called How to Get Happy. Kind of makes sense, really. He is Tal Ben-Shahar. Welcome.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Alon. It's so good to be here.
Great to have you. Tal, I want to start with a question about your personal life. I read that you played competitive squash and you were even the Israeli champion, and that at one stage you had this ambition to become a world champion. You followed Yan Shir Khan, you wanted to really see everything that he did. And then I read how you were playing like a high-level junior event. You were in the finals. You were dominating the match. I think you were 2 points away from winning. And then you started cramping. Can you share with us what happened there and how did that affect your thinking about competitive sport?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, growing up, squash was my life. I actually remember distinctly when I was 16, thinking, having this thought, what would my life be about when I no longer played squash? And I couldn't imagine it. It was the most important, most meaningful part of my life. You know, I trained hard. I worked hard, as you mentioned. You know, I worked with Yan Shir Khan, the then world champion. My world ranking was on the rise, and yet two things plagued me. One was I was unhappy and I was constantly stressed. And two, that especially, I especially struggled during big matches. So, you know, important tournaments, finals, where I would physically or mentally, and they're of course connected, I would cramp. And I realized then that as important as the physical training, you know, whether it's doing the court sprints or working in the gym or playing games, is the mental fitness. And that's when I actually got interested in the whole field of psychology, which is what I'm doing today.
And that leads me on to a real bottom line question, Sal, which is, how do you define happiness, and why is it the ultimate currency?
Yeah, so there are many definitions to happiness, of course. The definition that I work with and that I found most useful, again, not the only one nor necessarily the best one, but the one that I found most useful, was happiness comprising five elements. The elements are spiritual well-being, which is about a sense of meaning and purpose, which is about being mindful and present. Physical well-being, which is about, you know, exercise and nutrition and recovery and touch, physical well-being. Then there is intellectual well-being, which is about curiosity, learning, asking questions, growing, developing intellectually. Then there is relational well-being, number one predictor of happiness, quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. And finally, emotional well-being, which is learning to deal with painful emotions, which is cultivating pleasurable emotions. So these five elements that make up the acronym SPIRE, spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional, are the fundamental building blocks of a happy life. Now, they're the ultimate currency because everything that we do in life ultimately leads, or when things work out, of course, they lead to happiness. You know, I wanted to be a professional athlete, a squash champion, because I truly believe that it would make me happier. People want to make money because they really believe that it would make them happy. You know, if you were guaranteed that with every additional $1 million, you would become more miserable, you wouldn't go out there and get the money if you really believed that they would make you more miserable. You know, everything else, you know, success in sports, success in relationships, financial success, they're all valuable to us because we truly believe that they will lead to happiness. In other words, happiness, not success, not money, not prestige. Happiness is the ultimate currency.
So, Tal, with that understanding, let's say you were to pursue your career again. You'd be a top junior. You'd be thinking, what is the next stage? What would you do different to be happy?
Yeah, no, that's a question I think about, and also, you know, talk to my kids about it, because my three kids are competitive athletes. And I tell them a couple of things. First of all, I would pay more attention to psychology. I would read about it, think about it, study it. You know, just like I would watch, the squash games with Jeff Hunt and Jahangir Khan and John Scherer and Chris Dittmar, you know, the great players of my time and the generation before. And I would study those games. I would also study psychology, because it's an important part of the success formula. One, two, I would practice yoga. Today I'm practicing yoga, and the reason I'm doing it, the reason I started it, is because what ended my squash career was injury, back injury. And for years I struggled with it, and many people would say, you know, try yoga. And, you know, I said, you know, yoga is not for me. I need action, not, you know, I'm ADHD. I can't focus for, you know, unless I'm running. And I heard it enough times and read enough research on it that I tried it. It changed my life. First of all, I don't have back problems now. So yoga really helped there. But I noticed that I got so much more out of it than just the physical benefits. So for both the physical and the mental aspect, I would have every athlete do yoga, you know, some form of it, whether it's Hatha yoga or Iyengar or Vinyasa, whatever. And you see more and more athletes doing it, whether, you know, I see it in squash and also with basketball. You know, more and more teams bring a yoga instructor.
It's interesting, Tal, because we're talking about happiness, which is your topic, which is an incredible thing to focus in on. I can give you an example of a couple of famous athletes here in the UK who played for the team I follow, Arsenal. A guy called Paul Merson and Tony Adams, both who've been addicted to gambling. Or Merson was addicted to gambling and I think drugs, alcohol. Tony Adams, alcohol. Now, I think I've heard them both say that they had everything. They played for a great club. They got paid a lot of money, fame, fortune, what have you. But they used to go home and be miserable. They were not happy. This is going to be the same for a lot of athletes. Why?
Yeah, a lot of athletes, a lot of superstars in general. You know, whether you're talking athletes or movie stars or pop stars. Why? Think about the following scenario. Let's say, you know, you're a young individual whose dream is to become a famous footballer, and you're not happy as a child. You're experiencing a lot of stress and unhappiness and, you know, misery, in fact, but you're sustained by the belief that when you become a superstar, then you'll be happy. and you continue playing, you play for, you know, 5 years, 10, 15 years. And after 15 years, you know, they, you know, you get your minutes, you know, you're put into the game in the 70th minute, you score a goal and your career changes. And you're a starter for, you know, Arsenal or, you know, Bayern, whomever, you know, you become a superstar, admired, revered, you have more money than you know what to do with. You're, you know, admired by people around the world, you know, the most beautiful and sought after people want you. You have everything. You're set and you are happy because finally, after years of struggle and misery and unhappiness, you fulfilled your dream. And then a month goes by or a year goes by. And what happens? You go back to where you were before in terms of your happiness levels, because happiness is not sustained by success, no matter how great the success is. It's all about a temporary high. So you go back to where you were before, miserable, unhappy, with one very big difference. You no longer have the hope that you had before, because before you at least said to yourself, when I get there, then I'll be happy. But you got there and you realize that there is no there's there. And you know what the difference is between sadness and depression? It's that depression is sadness without hope. So you lose your hope because you've done everything that you were told you needed to do in order to be happy. You know, on a much smaller scale, I experienced that because I thought that when I would become the Israeli champion or win an international tournament, then I'd be happy. And I got there and I did it. And the happiness lasted for, you know, at best a few days. And I'm going back to where you were before, only this time without the hope. And that's when you start looking for answers outside of reality, because reality doesn't provide you what you were hoping for. And what's outside of reality? Drugs, alcohol, or the ultimate exit from reality, which is suicide, which is why we see so many very successful people who seemingly have it all choose an exit strategy from life, one or another. It's what I've come to call the arrival fallacy. It's the false belief that when we arrive, when we achieve, when we get to a certain peak, to a certain attainment, achievement, success, then we'll be happy. It's false. We don't. We need to find happiness in our journey. We need to find meaning in the day-to-day activities, and only that's sustainable. Not relying on the outcome, on the success, on the achievement, on the A, on the trophy, on the money, on that, you know, woman or man that we will have. These are all temporary highs.
So many athletes, like when they sit with their coaches or their teams, they set big, ambitious goals, and everyone tells them you have to have your dreams and you have to think about your dreams. What in your mind would be a healthy approach towards goal setting?
Yeah, so I'm all for setting big, audacious goals. They increase the likelihood of our success. What I'm not for is the belief, the false belief, that our happiness depends on achieving those goals. So let me share with you my take on goals, because most people have it wrong there. For years, that is what caused my misery and unhappiness, and it does so for millions, if not billions, of people around the world. So people perceive goals as ends. In other words, my end, my goal, my objective is to, you know, win this tournament or make so much money or create this or that business or have that kind of family. And when I do that, then I'll be happy. In other words, the goal is the end. This is a misunderstanding, because goals, in fact, are the means towards the end. The end is happiness. The end is a full and fulfilling life. The means are goals. How is that? So let's say, for example, that my goal is publishing a book, And let's say I haven't published a book, and you know, my goal, my life's dream is to publish a book. That's great. I need to set that goal. It's ambitious. And let's say I say on the whatever 20th of June 2024, I want this book to be on the shelves. I have a goal, an end in mind. As soon as I have that, I can let go of it. Because the important thing for me to do now is to write that book, the day to day, to get up in the morning and sit down and let's say spend 2-3 hours writing. And if I have that goal out there, then that goal liberates me to enjoy the journey. Because I don't need to think about, wait, what do I want to do with my life? Is this what I should do today or that? I know that every day I'm going to write for 3 hours, or every day I'm going to be on the court or in the gym for X hours. I know that I'm doing towards my goal, whether it's professional football or Olympic glory. That goal is there to serve me, to liberate me in my day-to-day, doing what is meaningful and important to me. I don't fool myself by saying it's only when I get to that goal, it's only when my book is on the shelf or when I stand on that podium, only then I'll be happy. That's the arrival fallacy. It's having that goal as important and meaningful and then focusing on the day-to-day. You know, you look at Nadal, for example. What's his greatness? Why is he able to overcome so many, you know, hardships and challenges, physical and mental? Because when he plays, he plays. He's not thinking, I can guarantee, he's not thinking at that moment about, you know, the Roland Garros or the Wimbledon trophy. He's focusing on the here and now, and that's why he's able to overcome the pain, the agony, and the suffering, because he finds meaning in what he's doing now. Of course he has that goal. But then he lets go of it once he's in the game or once he's in practice, the day to day. You know, my first book took me about 10 years to write and I didn't enjoy the process. Through writing that I learned, today I love to write. Because yeah, of course I have a book in mind that I want to publish in 2023. But I wake up in the morning and I simply write for 3 hours. And that is what provides me with meaning. That's what provides me with pleasure. That is what gives me happiness. Not the achievement of the goal on the book on the shelf. It's the day-to-day activity. Now, if you're not enjoying your day-to-day activity overall, of course, there's a lot of, you know, pain involved in professional sports. But if overall that's not a meaningful goal for you, then I would suggest looking elsewhere. But the goal is ultimately the means, not the end.
It's interesting you say that, and I get it, because obviously there's a famous saying, enjoy the journey, not the destination. However, I look at, as an example, boxers who literally stay, they go into camp, they go away from their family for possibly 3 months. They get up at 4 a.m. to do their runs. And then at the end of the day, why do they do it? In order to win that bout, that fight, to lift the belt. So I don't believe that generally boxers enjoy that day-to-day momentum or that day-to-day exercise. And you used to hear Marvin Hagler say, when he was the great champion he was, he said, it's very hard to get out of bed at 4 a.m. when you're wearing silk pyjamas.
Bed.
So there's a kind of contradiction there. Can you clarify that?
But very much so. It's an important seeming contradiction, because I'm not saying, you know, ignore the destination. I'm not saying, you know, in a sense, there are two schools of thought that are dominant in today's culture. One school of thought says it's all about the goal. You know, have a big, hairy, audacious goal, and that is what will get you up in the morning, and that's what, you know, will win you tournaments, fame, whatever. The other school says, look, they're not happy. Look at how many of them are on drugs and alcohol. They're not happy. It's all about the journey. It's all about being in the present, in the here and now. But you know, human nature is such that we need goals in order to get us out of bed, that we need goals to sustain happiness as well. So I'm not saying go to either extreme. It's all about the destination versus it's all about the journey. What I'm saying is bring both together. I still have a goal of writing a book. And you know, in the mornings when I don't feel like getting up, and there are such mornings for everyone, on those mornings, I say, look, you've set a goal. You've committed, whether it's to your students, to the publisher, or to yourself. And that gets me up in the morning. And then I start to write. And within 5 minutes or 20 minutes, I'm in it. Yeah, it's tough to get up, especially when you go for that, you know, 10-kilometer run first thing in the morning. But after the first kilometer or the second kilometer, you're in it. You're in flow. You're in the journey. But you got there because you have a destination in mind. In other words, you need both. They have to work hand in hand. You know, there's wonderful work by Anders Walsted in his book Peak. And what he talks about there is essentially the idea that very often we do need the extrinsic motivation. Sorry, it's Anders Ericsson. I was mixing him up with a squash player, Anders Walsted. So Anders Ericsson talks about how we need those extrinsic motivators to get us through the pain that is often part of peak performance. It's not all about intrinsic motivation. Oh, and I just love boxing, and I just love squash, and I just love writing. Yeah, it must be part of it. But part of it is also having the extrinsic motivation of, you know, I want to, you know, I want that, you know, knockout, or I want that, or I want that medal. They both have to work together for peak performance, intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, future and present, goal and journey.
Beautiful. You often speak about the difference between being a perfectionist and an optimalist. And seeing from the sports world how many top athletes really are perfectionists, they believe like success needs to be a straight line. They have a very small tolerance for anything going wrong. What can you say about the difference and how that affects performance and well-being?
Yeah, so it affects both in a big way. And when we talk about perfectionism, it's very important to have a nuanced understanding of what perfectionism is in the way that we talk about it. You see, when people are asked often in job interviews, so what is your weakness? Many would say, I'm a perfectionist. But of course, what they're saying is, I'm a perfectionist, meaning I'm responsible. You can count on me. I put 110% in everything that I do. That's what they mean by perfectionism. But perfectionism in the negative sense of the word has another meaning. Because I like the fact that I'm responsible. I like the fact that I put a lot of effort into what I do. So if that's perfectionism, bring it on. But that's not the kind of perfectionism that I'm talking about, the harmful perfectionism. The harmful perfectionism, or what psychologists call the maladaptive perfectionism, is about an intense and overwhelming fear of failure. Now, nobody likes to fail. However, an intense and overwhelming fear of failure leads to defensiveness. It leads to not trying. It leads to running away from challenges. It's about having this mental schema that says it's all or nothing. Either I'm perfect or I'm a loser. I'm either a winner or I'm a zero. My life is perfect or worthless. So it's going to that extreme that is harmful, because that extreme leads to an intense fear of failure, and it leads to not trying, and it leads to a constant underperformance. That's why I cramped when I was, you know, 2 love up and 7-2 up in the final. Not because I got tired, I was winning easily, but because my mind told me it's all or nothing. Either you're a winner and you're winning this international tournament, or you're a complete loser. And there is so much pressure and stress when there are only these two options. When my entire focus is on getting those next 2 points, because if I don't, that means that I'm no good. that I'm a useless human being, that I'm a loser. That's too much pressure to handle for, you know, what I was maybe 17 years old then. It was only later when I learned to embrace failure as part of the process. You know, the sentence that I repeated to myself then and that I still do today, and I talk to my kids and students about it. Learn to fail or fail to learn. You know, the famous Jordan, Michael Jordan video, Nike, I failed so many times and that is why I succeed. Or you look at all athletes. I mean, there is no athlete who just had a straight line career, you know, always, you know, winning everything, never losing. We've all had, as athletes, heartbreaks and failures and hardships. And that's all part of the journey of the process and ultimately of success. Learn to fail or fail to learn. You know, Kobe Bryant, one of the greatest, you know, he used to get on courts, on the basketball court early in the morning before practice and shoot. And he would miss many of his shots. And that's why he became such a great player. You know, we work out, we try. You know, why did I go, you know, and play with John Chirkan and train with him? Not because I would win every game, it's because I would lose every game. And through playing with him, I climbed up the world rankings. I mean, it's obvious you need to lose in order to improve. And truly accepting and embracing that can make all the difference. And that's about a psychological shift that we need to take. By the way, not just on the sports field, also in life. Because if you want a healthy relationship, be ready for conflict and arguments and failures and disagreements. Because that's how you learn about each other. That's how you learn about yourself. That's how you grow. Learn to fail or fail to learn, whether you're a scientist, an artist, an athlete, a business person, a parent, or a partner.
That's such a brilliant...
So how does an optimalist think and act and live?
Yeah, so optimalist is what many psychologists would call the adaptive perfectionist. And that is about working hard. That is about taking responsibility. That is about embracing failure as part of success. That is also another element of the optimalist. That's also about embracing painful emotions. You know, any athlete knows that, that heartbreak is part of the process. And if I say to myself, you know, I should be stronger than that, I shouldn't be sad, or I shouldn't shed a tear, what I'm immediately doing is actually raising the pain that I'm experiencing, preventing myself from learning and growing. So giving ourselves what I've come to call the permission to be human. The permission to be human is such an important part of the developmental process. Being an optimist is also about appreciating, not taking for granted our successes, our small wins, our small victories. It's not saying, well, it's all or nothing. Either I, you know, win that medal in that specific tournament or play for that team and, you know, and win that trophy, and then I'll be happy. No, it's appreciating every step of the way, whether it's the practice, whether it's the, you know, the small tournaments, whether it's learning from failure, appreciating that as well.
Can I play slightly devil's advocate here, Tal? Because I know you mentioned about learning to fail or failing to learn, and about athletes losing in order to learn. Well, not especially because, but there are two athletes, one of them in squash, who I remember, I think he had an unbeaten run going on a few years, which is Jahangir Khan, who right. was only beaten, I think, by the man you trained with, Jahangir Khan. What happened to Jahangir when he suddenly lost? And what happened to the 400-meter hurdler? I forget his name now. Who went unbeaten.
Moses.
Yeah, Ed Moses, yeah. Who went unbeaten for many years. And then he lost to Andre Phillips, I think it was, in the Olympics. And then you never saw him again. That is, if you like, playing devil's advocate to what you just said, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the challenges, and we see this, you know, one of the areas that I research now is management, leadership. And one pitfall of leadership and management is not having failed enough when you were younger. So you see these, you know, superstar managers and leaders who, you know, who rise very quickly, almost, not entirely, it never is, but almost a straight line up. And then they face their first failure. And then it's all downhill from there. Why? Because they didn't have enough experience failing. And that often happens to highly successful individuals. Now, with Moses, you may have never heard of him after that, but with Jahangir Khan, so his first loss, and, you know, he was my hero growing up. You know, his games are the ones that I would watch. He has the most famous game that he played with Jeff Hunt, even though he lost that. It was the last game that he lost for 5 years after. And then he lost to Ross Norman initially, who was a New Zealander. And after that, he lost to Jahangir Khan a few times. But that wasn't over. His career continued then, and he continued to win the British Open, which is the equivalent of Wimbledon or the World Championship. He kept on winning the British Open after that, even after he lost. Why? Because his focus was not on winning or losing as much as it was on just doing the work, on getting on court. And then, you know, when Jahangir came onto the scene, you know, he lost some and he won some. And he still played as the great Jahangir played when he was unbeaten. In other words, I'm sure it hurt when he lost to Ross Norman. No doubt about it. I'm sure it hurt when he lost to Jahangir. But then he collected himself. I don't know what he did privately, whether, you know, he talked to his coach, Ramat Khan, or he cried when he was by himself. It doesn't matter. But he went back to training. He went back and put himself on the line. And very often what perfectionists do is run away rather than work through it. And that is the difference. The fact that losing hurts, it hurts, period. Whether you've lost your, you know, after a long winning streak or whether, you know, you're in a losing streak. The key is to stay in the game. The key is to continue working hard. The key is to continue playing tournaments. The key is to continue to learn from your failures and from your successes. Stay in the game.
A related question to being a perfectionist, we see, and we talked about it before, so many athletes who are extremely successful still suffering from a lack of self-esteem. Mm. How can we explain that?
Oh, what a question, Alon, because again, so personal for me. I wrote my dissertation, my PhD work on self-esteem. And the reason I did it, you know, and I always write about things because I try to figure things out for myself. Carl Rogers used to say, what is most personal is most general. And I strongly believe that. So very personal question for me. It didn't make sense to me. You know, I looked at my life and I said to myself, how could it be that I'm struggling with low self-esteem? You know, I was a successful athlete. You know, I was a top student at Harvard. I was doing well professionally. I had a relatively good social life. You know, I had a wonderful, you know, girlfriend I was in love with, and she was in love with. I mean, I checked all the boxes. I have supportive parents, supportive social environment. You know, I have and yet I struggled with low self-esteem. It didn't make sense to me. All the books you read about self-esteem, whether it's the parenting books, not all, but most books, parenting books or self-development books will tell you. Tell your children they're amazing. Tell them they're smart. Tell them they're good. Tell them how much you love them. I was told that by my parents and by my loved ones. Or succeed, and then self-esteem will increase. And I was succeeding, at least by my standards. So why low self-esteem? And that's when I found other researchers who were talking about this. Not many, but there were a few out there, like Abraham Maslow, like Nathaniel Brandon, who were talking essentially about two types of self-esteem. And that's what I ended up writing my dissertation on. One type of self-esteem is dependent self-esteem. And that self-esteem, that, as its name suggests, is dependent on other people. So, Alon, you tell me, wow, Tal, you know, I really liked your book. of course that's going to increase my self-esteem and I'm going to feel good about myself. Or if I do well, let's say I'm in school and I do well on a test and I know that I'm in the top, you know, 5%, of course I'm going to feel good about myself. Wow, I'm better than 95% of the people on this test. That will increase my self-esteem, but it's dependent on the existence of other people, whether in terms of getting praise or in terms of being relatively better than others. Dependent self-esteem. In athletics, in sports in general, it's very often about this. Because you're praised, you get accolades from the outside world who tell you, wow, this was an amazing fight. Or you stand on the podium and you see yourself standing higher than others. That's gratifying. That's self-esteem, but it's dependent self-esteem. The second type of self-esteem is independent self-esteem. As its name suggests, independent of other people. Regardless of how I do relative to others, it's about simply improving and getting better. You know, yeah, of course, I love hearing when people say, you know, we enjoyed reading your books. You know, they made a difference in our lives. Very meaningful to me. Good for my self-esteem. It's also important for me to recognize that I'm improving as a writer, regardless of, you know, where I'm ranked relative to others. That's dependent. But independently, I'm actually getting better. I'm improving. I'm growing as a parent, as a partner, as a human being, independent of what others say or think or evaluate. That's the independent part. Another element that contributes to independent self-esteem, and that goes, Keith, to your point about boxers. And it applies to all sports to the nth degree. The other point is about experiencing flow, being in the present. So when you go for that 10-kilometer run and you're completely in it, you're experiencing flow. Or when you're training, even though it's hard and it's painful, but, you know, 2 hours have gone by and you didn't even notice, you were in flow. And these are the times when we are above time. These are the times when we are above criticism. These are the times when we're above praise. This is when we're truly in the present. And the present, the gift that we receive then, is independent self-esteem, self-efficacy, self-confidence that is priceless. Why? Because the more we experience flow, the more we're present, the more we can let go of that goal and simply focus on the journey, the stronger we become, the more mental, psychological muscles we develop that are independent of other people. You know, I think back to the work of the Maria Montessori. And you find many athletes coming out of the Montessori system. Why? Because Maria Montessori was very much about teaching kids how to be present independent of teachers or parents, just to be in the activity itself. And that is the kind of focus, concentration, presence of mind that is so essential for peak performance in athletics during the game and during practice. One, because you perform at your best, and two, because it cultivates your inner sense of well-being, your independent self-esteem, which is much more stable than the dependent self-esteem that is contingent on other people.
I presume self-esteem is hugely linked to one's happiness. Obviously, I'm waiting. Again, you'll come back to me and tell me. But you mentioned Nathaniel Brandon, who I believe said something along the lines of self-esteem is the reputation you have within yourself, or something like that, which would be kind of along the lines you just said. Now, I wanted to ask you, how do you develop that if you never really had that from childhood or developed it? How can you develop that? How can athletes learn that regardless of results, they can get that self-esteem?
Good. Yeah, so first of all, I'll read The 6 Pillars of Self-Esteem by Nathaniel Brandon, which is one of my all-time, life-changing books that I read. And then there are a few things that you can do. First of all, accept the fact that winning or losing affects your self-esteem, that it affects how you feel about yourself. You know, I give hundreds of lectures and presentations. Some are, I would rate as very good, again, all by my standards. Some not so good. And, you know, I feel great after a good presentation. I don't feel great after a poor presentation. Part of human nature. We are affected by what people think. Of course, it will affect me if someone said, you know, I really didn't feel like I connected to your material. Or someone will tell me, you know, I really connected to it. Yeah, it will affect my self-esteem. That's human nature. Accept it. Step one. Second, ask yourself, what are my passions? What do I truly care about? What's important for me? And then go out and do it. I mean, if it's being a top athlete, do that. If it's contributing in another way, volunteering in a homeless shelter or starting a business, do that. And by the way, it doesn't have to be one answer. It can be a few things. You know, it's very meaningful for me to be a parent, and it's very meaningful for me to, you know, to grow my business and to teach and to write. But the idea of passion, people who pursue their passions, who, in the words of Campbell, follow their bliss, not 100% of the time, that's not possible, but more and more of the time, they ultimately develop healthy, grounded, independent, strong sense of self.
Tal, on a practical level, what are some of your favorite happiness tools that you think athletes suffering from mental well-being could really use to improve their lives?
Yeah. You know, first of all, take the lesson from physical well-being and apply it to mental well-being. When it comes to physical well-being, we know how important recovery is. We know how important tapering is. You know, when I played professionally, that's 30 plus years ago, coaches were emphasizing the importance of tapering, of recovery. That's so critical, and that's essential for peak performance, not just physically, psychologically as well. Take time off, you know, take a vacation, do whatever it is that for you gets your mind off your off the stress and the pressure that's associated with sports. You know, there's a wonderful book by Jim Lohr and Tony Schwartz called The Power of Full Engagement. The Power of Full Engagement. And in it, they talk about, you know, the top athletes as experiencing stress just like everyone else does. And they know how to recover. Whether it's recovering between points, say when you were talking about tennis, or whether it's, you know, taking the 2 weeks off at the end of the season or a month and a half off, where you just, you know, train lightly or not at all. So having that recovery for athletes is key. That's when our muscles develop, when we recover. It's not when you're in the gym that your muscles recover. They grow. When you're in the gym, your muscles break. It's when you recover that they grow, not just physiologically, psychologically as well. So that's one. Two, learn to appreciate. You know, I do a very simple exercise, which I wish I had done when I was playing professionally. And that is every night before I go to bed, I write down at least five things for which I'm grateful, five things that I appreciate in my life. That would have for sure helped me in my career. There's research showing that people who do that are physically healthier and they're more successful, whether it's at work or at home. So learning to appreciate, that's very important for a happy or happier, as well as more successful life. Practice some form of mindfulness. You know, more and more athletes are doing it today, and for good reason. And, you know, do mindfulness with visualization, because your mind is in a very good place, very receptive place. In a sense, in a hypnotic state after meditation. So do your visualization after, you know, a 5 minute or 10 minute session. Do yoga if you have time for that. I strongly recommend it. Some form of mindfulness practice. Find a supportive environment. People you can really talk to about what you're going through. Because, you know, especially for the top athletes, it's very difficult to talk about what they're going through because many people are not, you know, empathic. You know, how can you, you know, what do you mean you're sad or depressed or anxious? You have no right to be. You're making so much money. You're so famous. You're so successful. You know, this is what recently happened with Michael Phelps or with Simone Biles is so important because it legitimizes, it normalizes stress or depression or fear and anxiety, because athletes, the best of them are human beings first and foremost before they're athletes, and therefore they experience the full range of human emotions. So have someone you can share with, you can talk to about these, and it could be a coach or a therapist or a best friend. It doesn't matter, but you need to have these outlets to express rather than suppress emotions.
And someone who gives you psychological safety so that you can really express your most vulnerable side.
That's exactly right.
Tal, I have to say that I'm enjoying listening to you, so I'm helping your dependent self-esteem right now by saying that. But no, I genuinely find what you're saying extremely inspiring, and I think our audience will as well. I know we're due to wrap up. First of all, how do people get to hear more about all your fantastic work?
Well, thank you for that, Keith. And you can find most of my work on my website, which is talbenshahar.com. Or my other website, which is happinessstudies.academy. That's with three S's, happinessstudies.academy. And that's where I share, you know, my books, my programs. And, you know, we have many athletes, professional athletes or ex-professional athletes or college athletes who are participating. And what they're finding is the deep, intimate relationship between success and happiness. So yeah, I certainly subscribe to, at times, no pain, no gain. However, happiness is not just about pleasure. It's much broader than that. It's about meaning, and it's about learning to deal with painful emotions, and it's about reaching out, and it's about self-esteem, and all these elements, yes, they're a part of a happy life. They're also part of a successful life.
The other thing, Tal, and I forgot to ask you it earlier, I've heard you talk about the paradox of happiness. Can you just very briefly explain that?
Yeah, you know, the paradox of happiness is important, and it's not knowing about it leads many people astray. So what is it? The paradox of happiness is that on the one hand, we know happiness is good for us. You increase levels of happiness, you become more creative, more productive, your relationships improve, you become more successful, physically healthier, you actually live longer. So happiness is a good thing. However, people who wake up in the morning and say to themselves, I want to be happy, or happiness is an important value for me, they actually end up being less happy. So we have a problem. We have a paradox. On the one hand, we know that happiness is important, but on the other hand, should I not value happiness? Should I not pursue happiness? How can I resolve this contradiction? Do I fool myself? Do I deceive myself and say, I actually don't care about happiness, wink, wink, it's really important for me. No, self-deception is not the way to happiness. What we do is we pursue happiness indirectly. I'll explain briefly. If I go outside, here is an analogy. I go outside and it's a beautiful sunny day. And, I look up at the sun. Looking up at the sun will actually hurt me. Directly looking at the sun will hurt me. However, what if I take the ray of sun and then take a prism and break down sunlight and then look at the broken down sunlight, at the rainbow, the colors of the rainbow. I'm indirectly looking at the sun. Now I can enjoy it, savor it, appreciate it. It's the same with happiness. Pursuing it directly, waking up in the morning and saying, I want to be happy. happiness is important for me. That's directly pursuing happiness. That will hurt me, just like it will hurt me to directly look at the sunlight. But if I break down happiness, just like I break down sunlight, and then pursue those elements of happiness, in other words, pursue happiness indirectly, that's when I can become happier. Now, what does that mean? Pursuing happiness indirectly is about, for example, allowing myself to experience the full range of human emotions. It's about doing what I love to do, pursuing my passions. It's about cultivating healthy relationships. It's about exercising regularly. It's about introducing recovery into my life. It's about doing the gratitude exercise. It's about cultivating healthy, supportive, intimate relationships. These are all indirect ways of pursuing happiness, which allows me to increase happiness levels while not being hurt by the paradox of happiness. Indirectly pursuing happiness is the key, the way to achieve more happiness in our life.
Thanks so much. I think this was really helpful. We're very grateful that you came to our show.
I'm grateful to you for, first of all, inviting me, and second, for doing the work that you're doing. I wish that podcast had existed 35 years ago.
Do head over to the Thrive website. That's www.thrive, spelt T-H-R, the digit one, V-E, dot space, where you can sign up for further giveaways and, of course, tips. That's www.thrive, spelled THR1VE.space. After all, this is your space to thrive.